Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're with us today. The people behind the nightclub massacre in Orlando and the carnage in Nice claimed inspiration from the terrorist organization Islamic State. Those incidents, as well as the quashed military coup in Turkey, have put Middle Eastern politics front and center. At the Republican convention in Cleveland, speakers criticized the Iran nuclear deal, which went into effect last year. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani called it, quote, one of the worst deals America ever made, end quote, and said the deal will, quote, put billions of dollars back into a country that the world's biggest state sponsor of terror, that is the world's biggest state sponsor of terrorism, end quote. Other speakers criticized the role that former Secretary of State, now presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, played during the 2011 NATO bombing of Libya. 5 years ago, there was tremendous optimism about the Middle East. Popular uprisings in Egypt, Libya, and other Arab countries seemed to herald a transformation of the region's politics. Some of those uprisings made temporary democratic progress. Others were quickly put into to a bloody end. Today, the Middle East has deteriorated into failed states and proxy wars. The terror organization Islamic State has expanded its reach, both in territory and online. What went wrong? Was the Arab Spring a failure or a flashpoint in the long-term struggle for democratic change? How should the next American president approach Middle East policy? Mark Lynch is a professor of political science at the Elliott School of International Studies at George Washington University. He's a contributing editor to the Washington Post political blog Monkey Cage, and he's written several books about Middle Eastern politics. His latest is The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East, published this spring. Welcome to Midday, Mark.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here with me in the studio. Let's pick up with that point 5 years ago. Many Americans think back to 2011. They look at how Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Iraq are faring today, and they include the Arab Spring was a failure. But you take a different approach.
Well, I mean, there's no question that the original hopes and aspirations from 5 years ago, I mean, those clearly have failed. I mean, if you look at the Middle East right now, it's pretty hard to look at this and see anything other than failure, military coups, wars, the horrors in Syria. And so from a very narrow perspective, yes, of course, the Arab Spring failed to bring about democratic, peaceful change. But there's more to the Arab uprisings of 5 years ago than that. This was actually a generational challenge to decades of authoritarian rule. I mean, these were people coming out into the streets, demanding change, making demands on their leaders and finding new ways to break through these systems that are hopelessly corrupt, hopelessly, oppressive. And they were going out there and trying to bring about change. And, so the failure part is that, of course, the regimes fought back. If you have these political leaders who will do anything to stay in power, that's exactly what they did. And so they found ways either to massacre their opponents, as in Syria, or to find ways to get back into power like they did in Egypt. And so if you look at the Middle East right now, it looks like the dictators are back in control in most places, at least in most places that aren't consumed by war. But they're much less stable than they used to be. They're much less legitimate. And the people are far more impatient and far more empowered than they were before. So when I say the Arab Spring didn't fail, what I mean is that this is a long-term challenge to the way these societies and states are organized. And, sure, the rulers can get back on the throne and hold on for a while. But this is a fundamental change in the way the Middle East works. And we're only beginning to see how that is going to play out and what it really means.
Let me pick up on you just said a whole lot. And you said the people are far more empowered than they were before the Arab Spring. That's hard for me to picture. I mean, it seems sort of in the same way that you say the authoritarian regimes are weaker, although you say that you sound very upbeat as you say that. So I want to ask you about that, too. But it seems to me that the populace, I mean, perhaps for me, Syria overshadows everything, the devastation, the, the displacement, the refugees. But it hasn't been easy in other countries either. It's hard for me to say that the people are more empowered.
Oh, no, it hasn't been easy for anyone everywhere, because these people are demanding fundamental change, and they're going up against states that are extremely powerful creatures. You know, they have, you know, very large militaries and intelligence and state security apparatus, powerful police forces. And in most parts of the Middle East, thanks to oil revenues and thanks to international support, they can command the lion's share of the economy, the share of employment, which is state employment, public employment in most of these countries is extremely high. And so you're starting from a point where the states have a much stronger position than the people. But what's changed is that with this generation across much of the Middle East, what you see is this almost unbelievably rapid increase in literacy, in education, in I like to think of as this cosmopolitan orientation. They're much more wired into the world now than they used to be, thanks to the internet, thanks to social media, thanks to cheap travel. You have this generation of you know, youth who are just, they have different horizons and different capabilities. So look at the coup attempt that just happened in Turkey.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, so you look at this a couple days ago, and one of the decisive turning points in that coup attempt was that you have this mobilized population. They're on their mobile phones. They're taking videos. They're coordinating online. And they're coming out against the military's intervention in politics. And that's just a microcosm of the sort of thing that happens across the region now. People are able to come together and get out into the streets and protest. Now, that doesn't mean that they can build anything. It doesn't mean that they can create democracy. But what it means is they have new ways of breaking through the power of these states to control things. So, I mean, and just to give you an example, you go back 10, 15 years ago, and you're living in most of these Arab countries, the governments had absolute control over information, over the news, over the media. And so your average, completely ordinary citizen, all they hear is what the government wants them to hear for the most part. And now people are absolutely deluged with TV stations, internet sites, information. It's just a totally new world now. And so everyone is adapting. Everyone is running as fast as they can to try and figure this out. And the regimes, these dictators and these powerful states, of course, they have the advantage. They're powerful. They're rich. They have this control over the commanding heights of the country. But in many ways, they're still running scared.
That is Mark Lynch here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Mark Lynch is a political science and international studies professor and author of The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East. You can be part of this conversation. What do you make of the aftermath of the Arab Spring? Is it on your mind? Is it what you think? Do you think there's any connection between the Arab Spring and ISIS? You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I want to plumb this example of Turkey for a minute, because you focused on what people were able to do to voice their opinion of what should happen when the military tried a coup. You look at the aftermath, though, and I think we're up to like 15,000-20,000 people who have been arrested or somehow taken into custody, sidelined after this. I mean, the power of President Erdogan he's really doubled down. I mean, he's known for anti-democracy moves against the press and protesters, and it looks like there's only going to be more of that. So I don't quite see how this fits into the idea, again, of people empowered.
So Erdogan and Turkish politics, it's really actually quite a tragedy, because in many ways what's happening is that Turkey is becoming more and more like an ordinary Middle Eastern state. For many, many years, if you looked at Turkey, what you had was this really intriguing model of an Islamic democracy, you know, a member of NATO, applying to be part of the EU, strong press, strong civil society, a strong political party system, regular elections. And and this was something which was a real outlier in the Middle East. What you've seen for the last few years is that Prime Minister, then Prime Minister, now President Erdogan, has been trying to concentrate power and trying to centralize control in his own office. And as you said, this has involved this really quite unfortunate crackdown on civil society, on the media. Well before the coup attempt, he was cracking down on universities, he was arresting journalists and closing websites, and trying to force through constitutional changes, which would basically allow him to rule like an Arab dictator in what used to be a democratic country. And this has been going on for a while. Then, about last year, if you recall, there was an election which actually brought in a new Kurdish political party, which was going to be able to challenge the monopoly of Erdogan's party in the parliament. And his response was really extraordinarily unfortunate. He responded by reigniting a war with this Kurdish population, which threw the entire country into violence and then triggered new elections, which, of course, he won. And so it's been, as you said, on this anti-democratic trajectory for quite some time. And the military coup, though, is something which, you know, Turks looked at this and they understood immediately what the implications of a military coup would be. I mean, all they have to do is look at Egypt and mm-hmm. see that a coup which promises to bring back democracy almost never does. And so that's what's so interesting about all of this from the perspective of Turkish secularists and Turkish liberals is that they're experienced and smart and empowered, and they immediately knew that this coup would be a disaster. But of course, now they're being exploited by President Erdogan, and now it's just paving the way to this really intensive crackdown. So the point that I was trying to make is not that we're living through this era of popular people power where you're actually going to see democracy winning out. You mentioned a moment ago the relationship between the Arab Spring and ISIS, and and that's something that would be interesting to talk about. But in a sense, what I'm trying to get at is that the states are facing all of these challenges from different directions that they're lashing out, using violence, using repression to try and resist, but they're getting worse and worse at it. And so when they fail, it's not necessarily the case that you end up with liberal democracy as the alternative. You know, the good guys out there protesting peacefully, it's not just that they don't always win. It seems to be that they rarely win. But they're still challenging the domination of those states and of those regimes. And so I don't actually necessarily believe that this is a good thing or a bad thing. It can go in either direction. But I think what's really important is to understand the trend where these regimes want to pretend that they're in control and they're really not.
We have to take a break here. Mark Lynch is with us this hour. He is the author of The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East. I want to pick up when we come back on the connections with ISIS. And I want to pick up on your calls and emails. You can email us at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. What do you think the United States should be doing in the face of these trends that we're talking about in the Middle East? Join our conversation. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about turmoil in the Middle East with Mark Lynch. He's a professor of political science, a contributing editor to the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog, and author of The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East. Mark Lynch, I think a lot of Americans' concern for the Middle East is primarily right now because they're concerned about ISIS and the terror that ISIS is wreaking across the globe. And that leads me to want to ask you about Syria. You wrote, the competition between allies that shaped every front of the new Arab wars was never more fully destructive than in Syria. Explain why Syria is a crucial point in understanding the whole Arab Spring movement.
So Syria began as just like the other Arab uprisings. You had challenges by kind of young, empowered, urban youth. using their mobile phones and all of this, rising up peacefully, trying to emulate what they were seeing in Yemen and Libya and Tunisia and Egypt. And it's a very complex story, but to make it simple, the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad responded with extreme brutality and extreme force in ways that most other Arab regimes did not. With the exception of Libya, most of the other regimes tried to find ways to split the balance between repression and co-optation. But in Syria, he responded with escalating force and for about 6 months or so, you had this nonviolent civil protest movement, which was taking increasingly horrible, bloody attacks from the Syrian military and the Syrian security forces. And as it began to escalate, you then had this escalating discussion about whether or not to take up arms and whether to turn this from a civil uprising into an insurgency. And at that point, you begin to see the active involvement of all the other players in the region: Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the United States, Europe. Everyone's starting to get involved. Russia and Iran and Hezbollah on the other side, in support of Bashar's regime, and it turns from a civil uprising into an armed insurgency by kind of early 2012, mid 2012, and. Once that happens, things go in a very predictable fashion, one which is extraordinarily destructive. So on the one hand, you have Bashar's regime, which gets enough support from Russia and Iran and Hezbollah to make sure that it can't be overthrown. They can always get more support, whether it's Hezbollah sending fighters in on its side, Iran sending in fighters, Russia intervening directly. With its air force and military last year. So they have enough external support to survive, but not enough to win. And then meanwhile, the opposition is getting this very uncoordinated support from all these outside players. Again, the Turks, the Qataris, the Saudis, each of them supporting their own preferred groups. And, they spend as much time fighting each other inside the leadership of the Syrian opposition as they do fighting Bashar. And so you end up with this very divided, fragmented Syrian opposition going up against this brutal regime, and it just spins wildly out of control. And there's all of this money and guns flowing in. The opposition is deeply divided. There's no real political control over it. And, that's the environment then where you get this unbelievable descent into really one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes of our times. I mean, at this point, we're looking at over 500,000 dead. Half the population has been displaced. And then you have this seemingly unstoppable war. And it really is unstoppable on its own merits because, again, every player in the war is able to get enough support from the outside to keep itself from losing, but never enough to win. If the opposition advances, Russia and Iran increase their support, and the same thing. If Assad is about to advance, new weapons and money and guns go into the opposition, and it just keeps this strategic stalemate going at this unbelievable human cost. Longer the war goes on, the more that those civil activists and the peaceful uprisers, the more that they're gone. They're dead. They're in exile. They're just driven away by all the men with guns. And the opposition becomes more and more radicalized, more and more extreme. And so, if you look at the lion's share of the opposition now, of the armed opposition, you're looking at groups like al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda branch in Syria, slightly less extreme, but still jihadist groups, which make up the core of the groups that are getting supported by Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And then all the way on the other side, you have the Islamic State, ISIS, which emerges out of that cluster of Syrian insurgent groups. And they're all in this cauldron of fighting, which is extraordinarily difficult to stop from the outside. And so, as we're going into the presidential campaign, you're going to be hearing a lot, I think, about ideas about whether Obama should have intervened and called.
Right. I was just going to say. I mean, at one point he drew a line and said, if mm-hmm. chemical weapons are used, the U.S. should intervene. But then he didn't. Chemical weapons were used by Assad in August of 2013, mm-hmm. 3 years ago.
And so Obama was absolutely determined to not intervene in Syria, to not get involved in another Iraq-style intervention in the Middle East. And, you know, one of the things which is probably most controversial in the book is that I think he was right about that. I think the United States getting involved in Syria would have been an absolute disaster. I mean, not getting involved has also been a disaster.
I was going to say.
But U.S. being involved in it wouldn't have made things any better. My basic take on it is that if we had gotten involved in the way that people were talking about in 2012, 2013, Syria would look a lot like it does right now, except that we'd be deep in the midst of it. Because the kinds of things that people were talking about, no-fly zones, safe areas, that sort of thing, none of it was enough to stop the war. All it would have done would have been to speed up the Russian counterintervention, the Iranian counterintervention, except that now the United States would be right there in the middle of it. And so Obama has tried to resist getting the U.S. directly involved, but you've seen it. Even Obama has gotten us dragged more and more into those wars. We now have more and more troops fighting on the ground in Iraq again, something which Obama was determined to avoid. We've got this quite intense bombing campaign going on against the Islamic State in Syria, and you can see Obama being dragged into it. I think after Obama's gone, I think you're going to have a more receptive administration, regardless of who wins, and I think we're probably going to see an escalation in a U.S. involvement, but it's difficult for me to see what good it's going to do.
Let me ask our listeners what they think about that prospect of more U.S. involvement in Syria and in the Middle East in general. You can be part of this conversation with Mark Lynch, author of The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East. You can be part of this conversation sending us an email at midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. So you're describing what you think would have happened if the U.S. had intervened more militarily. The U.S. did do training and did supply some support to some of the insurgents. Looking back on it with a clean slate, which the people involved at the time didn't have, is there an intervention that the United States could have done? It frustrates Americans to think that, and that is part of what we're going to be hearing in this presidential campaign, that the U.S. is powerless to affect a situation as dismal as the one in Syria.
And this is a deeply controversial inside the foreign policy establishment and people trying to make sense of this. But I fundamentally don't think that there was anything the U.S. could have done which would have led to a better outcome. And some people will say that's, okay, maybe that's right. Maybe a no-fly zone or airstrikes wouldn't have made the difference. But we still could have done more. And I keep saying, yes, but you can look at Iraq and you can see with 160,000 troops on the ground, we still couldn't turn Iraq into – we still couldn't solve Iraq. And nobody has called for that level of commitment to Syria. And so really what was on – in discussion were a lot of kind of small-scale interventions which would have played around the margins, but they didn't really get to the core of the problem in Syria, which was the fact that you had this genuinely civil – this was a civil war where you had external support to both sides, and the U.S. could have affected it at the margins but couldn't have solved it in any kind of meaningful way.
You made the point a few minutes ago that that it was essentially the authoritarian regimes fighting for their lives who killed the Arab Spring. One would have expected, these are authoritarian regimes that expect support from the United States government. That was some of the shock, that the United States did not support Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. So why wasn't the United States more able to influence those regimes in how they reacted to the Arab Spring?
These regimes want one thing. They want to stay in power. I mean, that fundamentally is their starting point. That's their raison d'etre. That's the reason for their for everything they do. And so, as you said, for many years, this was the bargain. The U.S. would turn a blind eye to their domestic practices in exchange for cooperating on security. And so as long as Hosni Mubarak in Egypt made sure that Israel was secure and, you know, was aligned against Iran and cracked down on terrorism, that was enough. And so we would talk about democracy, but no American president ever actually really tried to do very much about it because they understood that Mubarak was an important ally. When the Arab uprisings broke out, this wasn't about the United States. It wasn't something that we made or that we did. I mean, so back then, you remember this, you know, back in January, February 2011, people are saying, you know, why would Obama do this or why would Clinton support this? And the reality is that this was Egyptians out there in the streets. I mean, at the moment when the United States is deciding what to do about this, there's millions of Egyptians in the streets. They've burned down police stations all over the country. They've occupied the central square in Cairo. There's no way that the United States could have decisively affected that because this was a national struggle over the future of their country in which we mattered. I mean, certainly we mattered, but we weren't going to be decisive. And that's true kind of across the region. We can tell Saudi Arabia or we can tell, you know, whoever we want that we think you should reform. We think you should be more respectful of human rights and that sort of thing. But generally, the response that we get is mind your own business, you know, that we're going to do the things which we think are necessary to keep ourselves in power and you worry about yourselves. And so there's been a real breakdown, I think, in the relationship since the Arab Spring, the relationship between the United States and the other Arab leaders, because from their perspective, we violated the bargain. Right. We were supposed to keep them in power. And then when Mubarak was challenged, we decided to go for democracy instead. And they were just confused by that, furious about that, and quite shaken by it. You know, every one of these leaders, so Americans tend to like it when we hear our leaders saying things about democracy in the Middle East and freedom and human rights. I do too. I think those are things the United States should be trying to spread in the Middle East. But the leaders are against every one of those things. They want to stay in power. They don't want democracy. They don't care about human rights. And so they felt that we abandoned that we abandoned Mubarak. And if we abandoned Mubarak, why wouldn't we abandon them? And
so you're saying after Egypt, the U.S. had less diplomatic influence
than
it had even before.
Exactly, because they then saw us as a less reliable ally who wanted different things than they wanted. And so, you know, if you look at the last 5 years, the growing tension between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and frankly, between the United States and most of our allies in the region, it's been one of the big diplomatic stories of the Arab Spring. And you see it play out in the fight against ISIS. You see it play out in Syria. You see it play out in the Iran deal. Again and again, what you see is that the U.S. is on the other side of its most important allies in the region on issue after issue after issue.
Mike is calling us from North Baltimore. Mike, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Thank you for the concise and complete summary of what's going on with Syria, of course, as well. I guess I'm wondering, sir, whether you have information about non-governmental involvement in Syria, I guess, specifically, but part of the challenge for Americans is that we're somewhat enterprise or empire building just through our commerce and our capitalist outreach. So do you have information about things that have made it more complicated for us in Syria based on commercial relationships?
Mike, thanks for the question.
No, it's a great question. And, you know, one of the things about Syria is that it's become this central issue for much of the Middle East. It's become a focal point for all kinds of activism. And so if you go back to 2012, 2013, it might have been possible for the U.S. and other state actors to coordinate on what to do about Syria. But you also had all of these social forces that were mobilizing in support of Syria, and highly sectarian, highly Islamist, jihadist even, across the Gulf. They're raising money. They're channeling money into these radical groups fighting on the ground. And I think that helped to push the insurgency in a more radical direction. On the other side, you've actually had a really quite impressive support for Syrian refugees and for people trying to deal with the humanitarian aspect of this. I mean, one of the things which is easy to lose sight of is these millions and millions of people who have been driven from their homes and are living in Lebanon, in Jordan, in southern Turkey. And the international community at the official level has largely fallen down on that. They've tried, but it's been beyond their scope. And so you've seen a lot of quite impressive social, non-governmental mobilization to try and find ways to support the refugees, a lot of initiatives about trying to improve life in refugee camps, education, health, and those sorts of things. So there's a lot of involvement from around the region and around the world, some of it positive, some of it less so.
Mike, thanks for the question. Ed is calling us from Baltimore. Ed, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
In light of NATO involvement in Libya, Libya is today considered to be a failed state. In light of that, I'm kind of concerned about further U.S. involvement in the Middle East as one of causing as many problems as it might solve.
Ed, I appreciate your comment. Mark, what would you say to Ed?
No, it's a great point. And actually, my book actually starts, the preface of it, starts by looking at Libya, because Libya was an intervention that I supported. It's one of the only American military interventions that I've ever supported. And at the time, I thought that it was justified. And even looking back, I still think the arguments for getting involved were strong ones. I mean, there was an impending massacre. There was the opportunity to actually do something good at relatively low cost. But then I agree with you. You look at the fallout from that and what ends up happening in Libya and the state failure, polarization, proxy wars, and the collapse of the state. And I think you have to learn some lessons from that, that even something which was, by most people's judgment, one of the easier and most effective and most justified interventions has still failed. And I think that, when you look at any other kind of intervention, whether it's in Syria or elsewhere, I think you're right. You have to take into account the lessons of Libya and the difficulty of bringing about positive change through external military action and the fact that you always get unintended consequences and things never go as smoothly as we expect them to.
We need to take another quick break here. When we come back, I think we should talk more about how the U.S., the next U.S. president, will approach all these questions. How do you think the next president should approach Middle Eastern foreign policy? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the Middle East, what to expect and how the next president should approach, the next U.S. president should approach the issue. I'm speaking with Mark Lynch. He's a professor of political science, a contributing editor to the Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog, and he's written a new book, The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East. You're welcome to join this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Gene in Baltimore emailed us, and part of what he wrote is the conflict there is often posed as a conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia supports the spread of Wahhabism, which is similar to the ideology supported by ISIS. In this context, Shiism seems to be more moderate. Will there be a transition of power, of power center in the Middle East from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf to Iran? Demographics seem to support Iran.
So, I mean, there's actually two separate issues there that are both really important and interesting. One is the Sunni-Shia conflict and the sectarian conflict. And then the other is this grand balance of power, this grand struggle for power between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And the two are they're connected, but they're not the same thing. So at the level of grand strategy and the balance of power between Saudi Arabia and Iran, There's a clear sense in the Gulf and certainly among Saudis that Iran has been on the offensive, that they're on the march. And there's a real fear that the United States is going to basically abandon the Gulf in favor of Iran. They look at the Iran deal
as a
sign that the U.S. wants to switch over. From Iran's perspective, it's not quite so obvious that they're on the march. I mean, they're fighting this quagmire war in Syria. Their major ally in the region is now, you know, basically barely holding on in power. Hezbollah, which is their major proxy from Lebanon, is overextended and lost popularity. And they're looking at the nuclear deal, and they're getting very worried that they're not seeing the economic benefits which they had expected from the deal, because sanctions aren't getting lifted quickly enough and support for the deal is not as strong as it once was. And so you're in a situation where both the Saudis and the Iranians view themselves as kind of in this unstable situation. And that's not a good recipe for stability in the region. I think what the U.S. is trying to do and has tried to do is to try and find a way to bring Saudi Arabia and Iran closer together to de-escalate the conflict. But they're very much swimming against the tide, because both in Tehran and in Riyadh, they see this as this existential conflict for power in the Middle East. Meanwhile, thanks to Syria, popular level sectarianism is spiraling wildly out of control, like nothing I've seen before in the Middle East, where you're now seeing these really deep hatreds that have taken root out of all the killing and all of the instability. And, you know, so we thought this was bad a decade ago in Iraq, when you had the sectarian slaughters taking place in Baghdad. And now you have layered onto that what's happening in Syria and in Yemen and again in Iraq. And you have this popular anti-Shia sentiment, which is really something quite new and dangerous. And there's this sense of this being kind of the Saudis wanted to ride this tiger of sectarianism, and now it's turned around and they can't control it anymore. And so these are, I think, real factors for instability in the region. I don't think the U.S. really wants to abandon the Gulf. They're our closest partners. But there's no denying that this is a sentiment which is widely held in the Gulf.
What role do falling oil prices play in all this?
It's an enormous role. So this backlash against the Arab uprisings and this reassertion of control that I was talking about earlier, a lot of it rested on the fact that oil prices were very high, and these countries had enormous amounts of money that they could throw at the problem, both at home and abroad. Plummeting oil prices reduces stability. It means they don't have the assets they once did, and they're suddenly facing real challenges both at home and abroad. And so, you know, in Saudi Arabia, there was recently a leadership transition, and the new king and his son are trying to bring about this rapid, massive change in the way Saudi Arabia is governed. They have this very aggressive foreign policy now, this war in Yemen, and none of it's going very well. The war in Yemen has turned into an unwinnable quagmire. The economists look at this plan to transform the Saudi economy and transition it away from oil, and they see it as unrealistic. And so there's a real sense right now of Saudi Arabia both being stronger than it's ever been, but also extremely vulnerable.
You have used the word quagmire at least three times in the last few minutes.
Yeah. What? Many wars in the Middle East seem to turn into quagmires.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. What do you see happening over the relative near term, say the next 5 years, in the Middle East?
This is difficult to see anything good in the next 5 years. I think that if you look at there's a large political science literature on civil wars, and it suggests that wars like Syria's tend to last about 10 years. And we're 5 years into this one. And all the indicators suggest that Syria is actually on the worse end of this type of war. And so we could easily see this fighting in all of its devastating horrors continue for another 5 to 10 years. Yemen, the state has been largely destroyed. There's a humanitarian disaster, famine, basically it's difficult to see how you put Yemen back together. Libya, the central state, has been destroyed, and power has devolved to the local level, and there's intense polarization, powerful militias. And so you're looking at, you know, across the region, at least three and maybe more states that have more or less ceased to exist as states, and it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to stop the fighting and put that back together. Meanwhile, the states that haven't fallen apart, the ones that managed to regain control, they're like I was describing before. They're in control, but they're not stable. And at any moment, any one of them could suddenly experience the kind of turbulence that we just saw in Turkey or that we saw in Egypt a few years ago. And so what I think we're in for in the next 5 to 10 years is these wars are going to continue to rage, sometimes at a low level, sometimes flaring up to a high level. And then you're going to see what I like to call predictable unpredictability. You're going to see these regimes that we thought were stable suddenly consumed with mass popular protest again. And everyone's going to say, where did that come from? And we shouldn't be surprised because all of the conditions are there. If you look at a country like Egypt right now, every indicator of instability is worse than it was in 2010, just before the revolution. The economy, the political system, the levels of violence, you can go down the list. There's no stability here. Now, everybody in Washington wants there to be stability.
Right. So that's the question that you seem to be teeing up for us is what should the next administration be doing to try to manage this dismal outlook?
Well, see, there's a big gap between what I think they should do and what they will do. And again, I have to confess, I have a very difficult time anticipating what a President Trump's foreign policy might be. I mean, it's been kind of all over the place in terms of what he's talked about. But in a Clinton administration, I think it's very clear what's going to happen because she has a very long track record of the type of foreign policy she wants to pursue in the Middle East. And I think what you expect to see there is an attempt to reassert American leadership and rebuild American alliances. And I think she's been
alliances with the authoritarian regimes
and with Israel, and to try and, you know, go back to the way things were before the Arab uprisings, to try and, you know, rebuild some stability and have a stronger sense of American leadership and power. So I would anticipate that what you're likely to see is more direct American military intervention in Syria. You're likely to see more direct military involvement in other areas. And you're likely to see this more forceful assertion of American leadership in the region. And in my opinion, this is all then going to quite predictably fail because the U.S. actually does not have the capacity to solve these conflicts or to exert leverage over these countries. And I think what's likely to happen is we're going to default back to something very similar to the way we are right now, where we're trying to protect our most vital national interests. We're trying to nudge countries in a more favorable direction. But the reality is that, we're not the dominant power in these countries right now when you have leaders that are fighting for their lives and populations that largely distrust and dislike American leadership. And so basically this is the region is fighting its own wars right now. And there's real limits to what any American president is going to be able to do.
I want to see whether we can squeeze in a quick call from Aaron in Aberdeen. Aaron, welcome to the show. I think Aaron may not be with us. Is Chardin with us?
Hello?
Chardin, welcome to the show.
This is me. Hi, good evening. I have two questions. One is that we keep on saying that Turkey has an authoritarian government, whereas we see three election results. This guy, he won 50% vote. And I don't know what's the standard for being elected government or democratic government, whereas now we try to justify coup. Oh, it's okay. It's against the authoritarian regime. Whereas it should not be like that. It's against the democracy. And second is that ISIS. Is not ISIS U.S. and the European intervention in that region is long, long time.
Shardan, I'm gonna ask Mark to pick up your question because we're very tight on time. Thank you for calling. So I think Shardan is raising the question: is ISIS the result of foreign intervention? It didn't exist before the U.S. invaded Iraq.
Well, I think that the first question about Turkey is actually a really important one because Erdogan was, in fact, a popularly elected president, or first prime minister and now president. And Turkey has a long history of democratic institutions, and Erdogan has been a very effective politician. And the concern, though, is that his trajectory over the last few years has been anti-democratic. And what I mean by anti-democratic is not that, you know, he's winning elections too well. It's that he's been purging the military, purging the judiciary, cracking down on academics, closing newspapers, cracking down kind of across the board on civil society. And those are things that people have been talking about long before the coup attempt. There's been a deep concern about where President Erdogan was taking Turkey. And so when the coup goes out, and I was completely against the coup. I'm against military coups in general because I think that they almost always lead to disastrous results. But I think it's possible to be opposed to the coup and also to understand and to draw attention to the fact that Erdogan is taking Turkey in an anti-democratic direction, which is also very dangerous for Turkey's future. On the question of ISIS and, you know, kind of Western intervention and the like, I mean, there's all kinds of factors that go into the emergence of the Islamic State. I mean, but ISIS emerges out of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. I mean, that's where the organization which becomes ISIS was created. It was the Sunni insurgency against Iraq, against the American occupation of Iraq, which then metamorphosizes in a number of different directions. And ISIS is one of those directions. There's also decades of emergent Islamist activism across the region. There's the legacies of the Islamization of society. There's all kinds of factors that go into the emergence of ISIS. But I think it's accurate to say that you would not have the Islamic State in its current form without the American invasion and occupation of Iraq. But there's also a number of other things that go into the evolution of that jihadist trend.
We have just about a half minute left, and you've left me with the impression then that although you say the Arab Spring should not be looked at as a failure, that none of that life is left. I mean, as you look ahead, at least in the near term in the Middle East, there's none of that optimism, none of that drive.
There's very little optimism, but there's enormous energy and potential that still resides in the youth of the region right now. I mean, basically, they don't know the answers to any of these problems. They don't know how to solve any of these things, and their efforts to bring about democratic change have failed. But they're still there, restless and powerful. And if you look at, we're looking at 60-70% of the population want this sort of change. And so I don't know what it's going to look like, but I think it's coming.
I really appreciate your giving us some insight into it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch, author of The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East. I also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We're a country of increasingly busy people. What aspects of our culture and public policy are to blame for our time crunch? What can we do to get some breathing room? Tune in tomorrow for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.